Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, scholars note that the world is waging fewer wars, but that the wars that are waged are more brutal and intractable. And first, how much is the war in Sudan driven by a power battle between two generals? And how much of it is embedded in the relationship between Khartoum and the marginalized areas of the nation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On April 15th of this year, 2023, fighting broke out in Sudan. It's a nation that has had a history of conflict, protest, and resistance. The nation seemed poised to develop some form of democracy after the toppling of its longtime leader, Omar Bashir, and it appeared to be preparing for eventual elections, but in the meantime has been run by a council of generals, led by two military men at the center of this dispute, at the center of this conflict. They are General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of the armed forces, and in effect, the country's president. And then his deputy and the leader of the RSF, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who's better known as Hemeti. They're at the heart of this current war. On today's show, we're going to explore the recent events, the political military context of the war, the history of the war, the likelihood of a peaceful resolution, and ultimately, is Sudan a country that's on a pathway to democracy or continued military governance? Our guest today is Khan Madut. He is a part-time professor in the political studies in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Ottawa. And he's the author of Why Did Governance and Institutional Establishments Fail in Sudan and South Sudan? And Ethnic Mobilization Armaments in South Sudan's Quest for Sustainable Peace. Professor Madut, thank you very much for joining us. So the first question, why did this war break out? What ultimately is at the core of this dispute?
Thank you for having me, Doug. This war has several dimensions, and I can just start with the interesting one, that the two generals were actually allies for years working under Omar Bashir that now became adversaries. So they are a close general that knows so much about themselves. They worked together for years to actually put off the rebellions in Darfur. Another term that we could use here is, well, let us start that Burhan himself, coming from the military side of the Sudan, he's the person that actually provided the logistics to the Hamdan Dagalo, recruited the army for Hamdan Dagalo, and gave him all the leeway to do the fight on behalf of the Sudanese army as a counterinsurgency, you know, for the Sudanese army within the Darfur, as people who know the Darfur better and they're coming from that region. So that's need to be clarified. And then the other dimension of it is the post-independence Sudans, meaning when South Sudan separated from Sudan. A management of the post-independent issue, you have this big army that were used actually, not to fight only in Darfur, but all across Sudan to put up off rebellions all around Sudan. And now the South Sudan is gone and you still have that big army, which grow in power, actually become like parallel to the Sudanese army. And then the other dimension of that we need also to mention here is the ethnic dimension of it. The Dagalo groups started as Janjaweed. Now he doesn't like that terminology, Janjaweed anymore, because he wants to position himself as a statement. So the Janjaweed was actually a tribal group that classified themselves as Arab groups within the Darfur that waged war against African, or they call them non-Arab in Darfur. And the non-Arab are the group actually that have risen against the central government because of the issues of marginalization, and it could go as far as discrimination, unequitable power sharing, participation in the power in the center. So Dagalo and his group, or the tribe that technically started as they called Rezegat, and then their movement against the people of Darfur later on, took the name of Janjaweed, and then from Janjaweed to Rapid Support Forces, which is mobile forces. But technically, they were counterinsurgency that are supporting Sudanese government.
The Hamdan Diallo or Hemedti, this RSF that he commands, it sometimes gets described in, you know, news reports, as you just said, as the successor to the Janjaweed. And a reminder, the Janjaweed were who were accused of being the point, you know, military that was responsible for what's been described as the genocide in Darfur. So the fact he doesn't want to be called Janjaweed, at least in part, I would imagine, was not wanting to draw any historical parallels between his own position and accusations that Sudan has committed genocide. And accusations, by the way, that elevated to the point where its leader, Omar Bashir, has been indicted before the International Criminal Court.
Definitely, definitely. It is just movement from the tainted image of Janjaweed were active counterinsurgent in Darfur. And now the political construction, neo-political construction around now, I want to be a statement. So I want, instead of fighting as just like, rapid support forces, I want to address the all issues of marginalized people in Sudan and now Sudan. Let us not forget that there are three armed groups now with grievances that are still waiting to see who is going to be winner and what are their positions against them and what would they negotiate. One is the equity and justice movement that actually the rabid support forces were actively fighting them and created all the atrocity you just mentioned, you know, during Omar Bashir. And then the other one is Sudan Liberation Movement, also those of Abdelwahid that they were fighting from Darfur. And then you have Sudanese People Liberation Movement, SPLM, that were actually part of the big SPLM that were fighting also for the issues of marginalization. And some of them are in Kordofan and Blue Nile area. So those are another three groups that are just quiet now. They just want to see who is going to win and what is going to be their position, you know, when they win the power. Their current position is this. You fought us to support the central government. But now you went and you couldn't get access to the power. And we have these grievances against you, you know, Hamdan Dagalo. So for them, there is no difference between Hamdan and Burhan, because the two men were once allies that were fighting against them to put their rebellion off, even though some of them have signed actually some agreement with the central government.
And so with those groups, I mean, I know the with Equity and Justice, I think, I mean, that was a group that was fighting in Darfur back, fighting against the Janjaweed. They've been out there for quite some time. And what two of the groups I think you highlighted are based in Darfur. The other one is based, it's outside of Khartoum, right?
Yes, outside of Khartoum. Bulun Island, Kordofan, South Kordofan, I believe.
And so what you're actually describing now is a country that there's the battle between the two generals, but also this ongoing, at least political struggle, if not military struggle, between the center based there, you know, in Khartoum and the geographically separated marginalized communities within Sudan. Again, I remember during the Darfur genocide, there was so much conversation about how much this was driven by the fact that Khartoum, how much of Sudan is Khartoum in its immediate vicinity, and then how well integrated the rest of the country is. So I'm drawing from your description that the answer to that is not very well integrated.
Not very well integrated. And this is really good in the Sudanese context, war context. That's the starting point that we should start off historically just right after independence. The center has been the contested power sharing area for all the political group around the country. First, it started with Sudan as active. People were seeking to define themselves, not being into partial part of what we call, or they call then, is the Arab and Islamic states. And that's outright independent. The argument was, how can a 32% of the population take the identity of country of the more than 75% of the Africans that are from the periphery and they're not from Khartoum? Most people of center are in Khartoum and they don't want to, you know, to identify as Arabs and Muslims. And also they want to take that identity as the identity of the country. And that led to two wars between South Sudan and the North Sudan, which subsequently led to the independence of Sudan. But that didn't help also people like in Kordofan. And therefore, regardless, they are Muslim, even though they're not Arabs, also didn't help them because the war was so strong that before independence of Sudan, of South Sudan, that is Muslim and Christians, African Christian versus Muslim, that was the construction then. So at that, within that construction, people thought that if South Sudan there were Muslims, for example, that would have eased the war and get the solution, better solution. But the proposal was the same proposal that Hamek is coming with now. The proposal was, we need Sudan that is inclusive, socially, politically, and economically. Because the whole institution, as you just described, it is all in Khartoum. Social, political institutions are all in Khartoum and constructed around Arabism and Islam. That include, by the way, all the political parties that were seeking democracy and said democracy and who ruled the country. It is just within that political paradigm of Arabization and Islamization of the country. And if you go deep in the history of Sudan, even though we will call some other military coup that have taken place historically, most of them were not military coup. Most of them were actually partners between political elites or political parties elites and the army and their supporters in the army. So they will design all these military coup takeover, and then they will come and rule, whether they rule in the military uniform or later on to try to take them out. So I will give you an example, like Numeri, for example, military coup. That was actually the Communist Party, Sudanese Communist Party, that were actually collaborated with their supporters. And the current Omar Bashir as well, the military coup, that was actually Islamic Brotherhood political party that collaborated with their army in the system. And that those of Burhan now, they are actually partial part of those Islamists that collaborated with Muslim Brotherhood then.
Yeah. And actually, you've highlighted an interesting development within Sudan, because you mentioned Numeri, the longtime, the leader here, who, again, my understanding, represented more of an Arab identity. And then the rise of Omar Bashir ended up pivoting a bit towards more of an Islamist identity. So I think from your comments, I would take from that the current leadership would still embrace Islamism over Arab identity broadly within the country. So I guess my question, first of all, is that correct? And if so, why? And what does this mean for Sudan to be more of an Islamist rather than an Arab nation?
No, my reference is coming from the proposal that was proposed by the Sudanese, South Sudanese then. Sudan hasn't changed. It is the same central governments, the same political paradigms, the same institutional instruction or construction around. Sudan is an Arab and Islamic country. So anything should be constructed or built around that. Any negotiation, there are no compromise around that. And not only that, the access to power or privilege has to be from the people of center. So people of center always monopolize power. So where is the trick here? Hamdan, as a counterinsurgency, and all the power was given to him, he managed to build a parallel army. And that's the only way for him to come into the power. He was rest assured that post-dividends of deposing Bashir, he might have gone up the ladder. But that was not what in the mind of those of Burhan. What in their mind is that you have done your part, we have deposed Bashir, now we want to integrate your army within Sudanese army, led by who? Led by Burhan from the center. Then Hamdan is like, then what is the incentive for me? A person who have, and usually he used that in most of his interview, I lost so many people of my, ranked people, my officers in the war. That's the grievances. The other ones, he built himself regionally and internationally. He managed to engage in international relations. He managed to engage in the trade through Libya with those of Haftar, the digging golds with those of Wagner's group now becoming part of, partial part, even though they are denying, but they had like really active trade working there, backing by, United Arab Emirates and also, Soviet Union or Russia. Yeah, Russia, let us say Russia. So he built himself. So what is incentive for him if his forces have been integrated and he got stripped out of the power? So technically, that's where the sticking point is, and that's where the solution for this war is going to be so difficult unless one wins and then prove themselves whether they're going to be statement and also address all their grievances. Because as long as the grievances of Sudan, especially people of peripheries versus people in center, if that is not resolved, I need really person with good vision to be able to do that.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the conflict in Sudan, the war that's broken down in Sudan, with our guest, Khan Madit of the University of Ottawa. So actually what we're digging in here, to me, since this war has broken out, what I've wrestled with, real typical political science question, how much of this is about personality and the positions that the two generals, you know, have been able to take? And you've highlighted this, that Hamdan Dagalo has a parallel army, and the question of whether or not he's going to integrate it at one level is, will he surrender his forces to Burhan? But there's also this deeper issue then. So I want to delve into this a little bit more. Hamdan Dagalo was empowered to put down insurgencies, put down rebellions, you know, fighting outside of Khartoum in the different areas. And then that process, you're saying he's built power bases outside of there. So how much of this conflict, I mean, again, at the end, is it Burhan representing Khartoum and Hamdan Dagalo? Ironically, he was supposed to fight against these insurgencies, but because he now has these alliances, that he represents at least the interests of the areas outside of Khartoum. And so therefore, this really isn't about two generals. It really is about Khartoum versus the regions.
Exactly. And a lot of these things, a lot of these things for both generals. For Burhan, it's not only power and also his power that is being threatened by Hamdan Dagalo, but also to assert his power over the whole Sudan. And for him, he was clear that the purpose of Hamdan is not a power sharing to begin with. It is just like an insurgent or counter-insurgent that was used actually to put up the rebellion. But again, a lot of now, Hamdan have built his power. Not only built his power, he got an easy way to access power, because technically, he's supposed not to be anywhere around the vicinity of Khartoum, of the, you know, presidential palace, you know, army headquarters. That's not where he's supposed to be. Technically, he's supposed to be in the battlefront. And that's from battlefront that where he managed actually to send some of his forces to fight in Yemen and get money for that, and built all this alliance around the border regions with Libya, and also built big trade around that, you know, because he was at the front. So with the process of toppling Bashir, and also he was needed as Robert, because they were good at fighting, like the urban warfare. They were so good at it. So they were called initially actually just to put up the pro-democracy, you know, call for a democratic and a toppling of the Bashir. And then when they were there, they came with good enough men, you know. That's the easy and strategic way for them to access actually the palace now. And not only that, he made it to a seat of the power. But for Hamdan, now the threat is he a right person? Are we able to work with? What is he calling for? He may call for something like vice presidency. It usually works even with South Sudan before. If you just want a vice presidency, you don't want to interfere of the Sudan affairs, leave everything as it is, then that was used to be fine usually with a central government. So sometimes they'll call you as a second vice president or third vice president, like what is happening now in South Sudan. So that would have been good with Hamdan. But for him, it's not only that. They want to take his power. They want to strip everything. And the person, or a person of Hamdan, is like, no, my position, the way I came here, I need more dividend than this. And not only that, we need some reform. We need to take the advantage of this partnership so that we can bring everybody from peripheries to come and join us in a power sharing. But again, we know the slogan always that the generals use. And I still have my own doubts that if he came to power, he's not going to be a guy, you know, guardian of the democracy. I think he just wants access and power. And the same thing with Burhan. He's not going to give back, if any. He will just extend the rule of Omar al-Bashir, or the same ideological path of Omar al-Bashir. Yeah. Now, as far as supporters are concerned and fans, you will see when it comes to issue of center versus periphery, people will drop everything, people of center. They will drop everything and support the army. They will say, well, we're supporting the army. Not because they're supporting the army, but because now it's the periphery against the center. So center could be taken with any other political party, which is center-based, but not anybody from peripheries. Because they call them, there is a slogan that are going out now, I will say it in Arabic, that Ibn al-Badi la yahumna. So meaning people who are of nomads cannot rule us. You know, sons of nomads cannot rule us. That's like they say now it's going on. So technically, we don't want anybody from periphery. So so the support now is aligned around that, like you. But Hamdan have failed to recruit. Maybe later on, that war, and that's my fear, is going to be attractive to all marginalized people of Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
Because for now, they are just worried of revenge, cycle of revenge. But later on, it can be an attractive movement.
And that, of course, was the pattern during the war in Sudan and in Darfur, et cetera. Now, I'm at the pains of an analogy that's far from perfect. I'm tempted to point out that what's going on in Sudan and what you just described is remarkably Roman in the sense that Caesar had fought all the battles on the periphery, but then would he actually return to the city? Would he cross the Rubicon? And the reason why this analogy is so striking to me for all of this is by crossing the Rubicon and going to Rome, it toppled the Republic. So I'll use this as a transition to talk about our last topic, which is again about democratization in Sudan. So you're describing these two generals that represent regions, represent poles of power from Khartoum, from the periphery. But this was a state that was poised after toppling Omar Bashir to become democratic. This is a huge challenge, been a huge challenge across the entire continent of Africa, Latin America as well, but even more so in Latin America, that when you have a military government that is ostensibly committed to democratization or at least civilian rule, that step from the military surrendering power either to a democratically elected government or civilian rule, when it happens, it's usually the case of a general just taking off his uniform and declaring he's now a civilian leader, and then at some point holding an election that will ostensibly legitimate him, but in reality, he's never surrendered power. Is that likely the scenario in Sudan? Has this war really dashed any hopes of some real democratization in Sudan?
Definitely, I also know, and my intuition will say, I will ask the question, why didn't one of the generals supported Hamdok, for example? And that would have been a best option for Sudan. Because with the military, with the civilian rule, the potential for a conference, national conference, to bring everybody in and decide what kind of rule they want, you know. And that's the thing that I said, like post, when it, I mentioned things like post independent issues management, is one of them is the issues of diversity, for example, that led to the separation of South Sudan, is still not managed well. And then people were moving towards democracy while there is no coherent or inclusive political paradigm to move people towards that. And also, it is a non-well phenomenon in the region. People will come using the slogan of democracy and will give democracy. But yes, at the end, it is just like contestation. They're going to contest. They will change the uniform, put on civilians, and then put up some kind of, for lack of a better word, fake election. And they will come as leaders, new leaders for the country. So with all the complication, it's still the best option for Sudan is those generals and those army going back to their barracks, support the kind of military and not just civil rule with what they call visionary leaders that will incorporate all the causes of the Sudan issue, Sudan problem, not only Khartoum problem, but Sudan problem for people, the equitable distribution of wealth, the equitable power sharing, the right of citizenship around the country for every Sudanese to find themselves as actually a member of that country. Or citizen of that country.
And external actors have played a role, certainly since the toppling of Bashir, in trying to build civil society, you know, trying to strengthen civil society, strengthen democratic voices, at least ostensibly. That's what they were doing. But there's been a lot of critical reflection, in some cases, self-reflection, certainly external reflection, and pushback from Sudanese civil society that said that actually is not what they were doing, that instead they were this reinforcement of military rule has been a real, is in part, I don't know if we can blame external actors, but external actors didn't do a very good job of trying to empower civil society. And that at the end of the day, they really did a disservice to a number of Sudanese groups that were committed to democratization. Is that a fair assessment of what these actors have been doing?
Yes, the only thing that I would like to add here is the fact that I would like a bit political elite within South Sudan, civil political elite, not even the army one, to take some kind of blame around that. Because when it comes to political competition, if one is threatened, then sometimes they will actually use the army to bring them into the power. So those are the areas that they are also need to fix, that they need to look critically about, is this actually helping Sudan? Because like they have tried since it's independent. And as I said, many coups that happened actually has some kind of political parties taints on those military coups. So they will start as democracy, people will go to election, and if one political power is gaining more momentum, then you will see one of the other political parties will go and ally with army and take over and destroy democracy. That is more into internal geopolitics more than the external factors, actors. But if we want to pull in external actors, it's just the fact that there's not any democracy thriving around the country. All seven countries that surround Sudan, there's not any role models that they could use. The African Union is being led now by generals, technically. Those are not civil leaders. So those are the challenges that actually will face democracy in Sudan.
And the size of the country, how many countries border Sudan, the size of the population, all of this portends to, first and foremost, needing to get the armies back in their barracks, first and foremost, because the casualties coming out of Sudan have been substantial, but the potential is even so much greater, if this continues. But ultimately, those of us, and I will put myself in this camp, that are still guardedly optimistic about democratization throughout the world and certainly throughout the region, it's taken a hit with this conflict. But let's hope that at the end of the day, we can see clear towards supporting democratic movements within the country, because I believe through democratization is probably the best way to stabilize Sudan. Our guest today has been Khan Medet. He is a part-time professor of political studies in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Ottawa. He's the author of Why Did Governance and Institutional Establishments Fail in Sudan and South Sudan? And also Ethnic Mobilizations, Armaments, and South Sudan's Quest for Sustainable Peace. Professor Medet, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
When we come back, scholars say the world is waging fewer wars. What are we learning about peace and peacemaking? And can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What have we learned from past conflicts and peace processes, and can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? We revisit the wars in Congo and Syria from a segment we recorded in 2013. Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. George Lopez was previously Chair and Professor in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle. We have, according to some scholars, seen that the world is engaged in fewer wars today, but we still have a lot of conflict. First of all, is it true that we're getting less violent as a humanity? And if so, what is working and what is not working? George Lopez?
Sure. Thanks so much. I think in terms of the recent data, it's certainly the case that there is less formal war. There's less internal war than there was 15 years ago. But one of the things we find is that when war is still ongoing in places like the Congo or Syria, it's much more intense, brutal, and elongated than we've had before. It's also the case that the degree of fallback after peace agreements try to take hold for 2 or 3 years has increased over time. So we have some good news and we have some bad news. In terms of what's worked, it's very clear that we learn a lot about what makes a solid peace agreement work and all the dynamics that must go into it, maybe as many as 13 or 14 primary factors. Particularly external support, the need for economic development plans, the need for full participation quickly in a national reconciliation process. But it's also the case that with the Syrias and the Congos, there isn't the full international commitment and resources to try to get behind the peace process and empower local people the way it works in some other conflicts.
Irvin Staub.
Well, it's true that in some sense violence has diminished, but at the same time we have such intense high-level violence in a lot of places that it is almost complacent to talk about decrease of violence. Some of those are what George mentioned. The Congo, he didn't mention the Sudan, where there has been ongoing violence of an intense kind. So it's very problematic and we must focus on how we can prevent it. I think that for me, somebody who is concerned with how we can go at this from different perspectives, but I'm rooted in psychology, one of the issues is how we can develop more positive attitudes by groups of people towards other groups whom they live with, whom they are in the same society with. And we can't only talk about what it is that we need to accomplish. We also need to talk about how we can do that. And we know from a lot of research that creating joint projects where people work together for shared goals is very important. It's important with kids in schools. It's important with groups in societies. Another really important thing from my perspective is to create positive visions that include everybody in society. Usually when there is violence within a society by one group against another, a destructive vision or ideology develops. What it is that we need to create for our group in order to enhance the well-being or protect the security of our group. And that can be very varied. It can be nationalism. It can even be the vision of social equality, which the Khmer Rouge propagated. But usually, in the cases of such visions, some group is identified as an enemy that stands in the way, and then often it leads to an attempt to destroy that group. So to create positive visions that includes everybody in that society and brings people together so that they can work together for shared goals is extremely important. I also want to mention the issue of healing from past victimization. People, individuals, and groups who are victimized see the world as dangerous, and they very easily lash out when they are threatened again, believing that they need to protect themselves by force, and they become perpetrators in the process. And we have some ideas of how to create healing processes. I also want to mention the issue of justice in these societies. You know, people who have felt victimized or been victimized usually deeply yearn for acknowledgement of what was done to them and some kind of justice. And this can go on for a long time. You know, in Argentina, after the disappearances, everybody received amnesty. And then 20 years later, there was a new justice process because there was so much unhappiness and unrest in society about the unfinished business of victimization and injustice. So there are a few others that are very important. I will mention just two things finally. One of them is the issue of generating what I call active bystandership. Often leaders don't do what they should do. They also remain passive bystanders in relation to what happens in other societies. So citizens have to become involved and propagate actions by their leaders. And the earlier countries respond to what happens in other countries, the less need there will be for force, for violence, for military action. And finally, in all societies, there is an issue of child rearing. How to raise children so that they become what I call inclusively caring, meaning caring not only about people in their own group, but also about other people, and morally courageous enough that they can take action.
And perhaps then they don't elect leaders that are warmongers in democratic societies. So Irvin Staub has just been laying out the societal level things. Now, Noren Ripson, you've looked at things from the state level. What do we see there?
My research focuses on building peace between regional rivals, a particular kind of rivalry. And what I've found typically is that when regional rivalries resolve themselves, it's not because of societal pressures. In the first instance, it's because of states, that is, state pressures, state interests, whether they be alternative threats, more pressing threats internationally, whether it be pressure from great powers, particularly in an era of hegemony where there's one state that's far more powerful than others, the hegemon, or whether it's simply state survival interests, regime survival interests, and the perpetuation of the power positions of the leaders in power. And then ultimately afterwards, when it comes to peacemaking, afterwards, after an agreement is reached, then if the agreement is socialized and society is brought on board, you can have a successful agreement. Whereas when society is not brought on board afterwards, you tend not to have a very successful agreement. Now, on the general question that you posed, I think that right now we are in a moment where the evidence is incontrovertible that warfare, interstate warfare, has declined, particularly in the developed world. The question is whether this represents a trend or whether this is a particular moment in time, whether it's a moment in time because of the presence of a liberal international hegemon in the United States, which has no challengers. I mean, there are other states that may be dissatisfied with the United States and its leadership, but they don't have the capacity at this point to represent significant challengers to it. So whether the question is whether the reason why we're in a moment of greater peace now is because of American hegemony, whether it's because of the spread of liberal values and liberal norms worldwide, whether it's because of globalization and the spread of economic benefits, whether it's because of the destructive capacity of war, as some scholars suggest as well, that makes war at least more difficult to contemplate because of the costs, is unclear at this point. But the question is whether this is simply a moment, and in the event of, say, the rise of great power rivalries again, or, say, in the event of some kind of ecological disaster or even economic crisis beyond what we have right now, where states start calculating in very different terms, perhaps in 20, 30, or 40 years, we might not be in that moment of greater cooperation. So there's really a question about whether this is an enduring trend or whether this is simply a moment in time, like we've had other moments throughout history where conflict was suppressed or reduced for a period of time, but then reemerged.
You brought up interesting points like the environment, like what's coming with climate change. Will people handle this in a peaceful manner? One other thing that Irvin mentioned was about the creating a peace and reconciliation process. Perhaps we should look at that also. George Lopez, let's go back to you now and let's look at some of these big questions. In terms of what we know now, what needs to be done to prevent bloodshed?
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And I think when you look at Congo, CAR, and Syria, we're talking about places where all the mechanisms I want to mention actually never got a chance to take hold, partly because of internal anarchy or because of dictatorial rule. And I think one of the things that it's often difficult to convince public audiences and policymakers alike of is the number of cases that turned not into large-scale violence, because what we were able to do was to put in place the preventative or violence mitigating mechanisms that we've learned in the peace-building enterprise over the last two decades. Specifically, for example, if you look at some of the things that were going on during peace processes in Colombia, in Ireland, more in Burma, to a certain extent in Tunisia in the midst of the Arab Spring, what we had was lots of international agencies that do training in everything from security sector reform to police monitoring and retraining to civil society engagement, training people in the values of conflict resolution, the kind of inclusiveness that Irvin talked about at every level from schools through civic organizations and the like, training people without very much experience in democracy in their country to the virtues of broad scale participation and national dialogues. All of these kinds of approaches have been used since the terrible wars in the Balkans in the early 90s taught us that you really need to engage civil society in order to prevent a war of all against all. We've not been able to do that in a Syria or a CAR, but in so many other places we have been. And these are interesting human technologies, human institutions, ways in which we learn that the technologies of peace run the gamut from simple training in mediation and negotiation for community leaders all the way through how you reform the police and the armed forces to be both more inclusive but to understand a very, very different role for themselves in building a new national order. You know, you mentioned Mr. Mandela, of course, is that one of his powers was the ability to call people to an identity and a purpose beyond their self and their existing trained prejudices. And we can do that in a number of ways. And there's so many international and domestic agencies that do that so well.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about what we've learned about preventing and ending violent conflict. In terms of the international hegemon now, Noren Ripsman, I want to go back to you. The U.S. has tried and failed, or maybe hasn't tried hard enough, to bring peace into regions like the Middle East, for example, Israel, Palestine. How vital is it that the hegemon, the United States, play a role there? And if it's not there, what could happen?
Several issues that you raise and that I want to address that were raised before. But first of all, I think it's essential. In order to bring peace between rival societies, states and quasi-state actors have to have key interests that allow them or that persuade them that despite societal hostility, and there's intense societal hostility and antipathy, that they need to take risks and make significant concessions in order to reach an agreement. Now, to begin with, that means that hegemonic engagement is essential or very important. It could happen without it, but it's very important to try to create incentives, both pressure and opportunities for these states in question. But beyond that, the hegemon can't drive the process. The hegemon has to look, and other third-party actors, not simply the hegemon, great powers, international institutions, have to look for opportune moments. They have to look for moments when conflicts appear ripe for resolution. And any efforts they expend at times when conflict isn't ripe for resolution, when there aren't, say, competing threats that are of greater concern to one or both of the parties in question, or when one or both of the parties in question perceives that it has economic interests that may topple the regime, that may threaten the hold on power, and therefore may make an unpopular peace treaty essential for their own purposes, then it may not be an opportune time for outside forces, including the hegemon, to gain leverage over a particular case. One thing I want to address, you know, with regard to this is that I study what I'd like to joke are the easy cases, intense rivalries between regional states. I joke that they're easy because they're not easy, but they're a lot easier than some of the types of cases you've been talking about, where you have either poorly institutionalized states, non-state actors, such as, for example, the Palestinian Authority, or where you have societies with, in the absence of any kind of state institution or top-down hierarchy. And under those circumstances, it becomes a lot more difficult to overcome societal animus. What you need is a strong state in order to be able to reach a decision and carry a decision and then socialize a decision over time. Absent that, societal engagement is great over time, but it's a much longer-term process. And so trying to engage in making peace by engaging society may take, you're talking decades rather than short-term solutions, and a lot of people can lose their lives in the interim, whereas with a state to be able to take a, what may be a very unpopular decision to make a compromise and make concessions can actually do that in a shorter period of time, and there's willingness.
It sounds like you're arguing is that statehood would matter for Palestine. Is that what you're saying?
State building may be very helpful. I think the circumstances were far better earlier in the new millennium because you actually had an entity that wasn't divided on the Palestinian side. And then the idea of building state capacity to be able to reach concessions would have been very appropriate. Now that it's divided, it's not really clear that you'd actually have a unified state that it would be interested in and able to be able to reach a peace agreement. So the moment there may actually have evaporated.
I know Ervin Staub's also been engaged in that region. Ervin?
I have some things to say about a number of things that my colleagues have said. So let me start with some of that and then go to Israel-Palestine. One of these is that the role of external parties is extremely important, and they have to work with internal parties because it's internal parties that are in a position to make a change. But from my perspective, it's not only a hegemon like the U.S. now that can exert very substantial influence. Other countries can also, especially countries that have some kind of a relationship to the people in power in a particular situation. Unfortunately, people who have that kind of a relationship often, because of that relationship, remain silent and they don't exert influence. But if other parties can work with these external parties so that they will exert influence, like, for example, the Arab countries in relation to Israel-Palestine, that can make a tremendous difference. Also, and among other things, the media can be very powerful in creating change. So, for example, in Macedonia, where there was violence between groups there, a number of journalists from different ethnic groups came together, went and interviewed people belonging to these different ethnic groups, and wrote stories about their lives, lives that were extremely similar. And then they published these stories in the newspapers of each of the ethnic group. And that kind of thing can humanize the other, show similarities amongst us. Also, talking about external, internal collaboration, various NGOs from the outside have prepared ideas for a new constitution in Macedonia. And some of these ideas were included in this new constitution that addressed some of the rights issues and contributed to peace. One other issue, we were talking about interests, and economic interests and various interests and the parties' interests have to lead them to take some kind of action. Unfortunately, ideology often trumps interests. If you look at Israel-Palestine, you could say that creating peace has there been in the interest of both parties for a very long time. But on the Israeli part, for example, the ideology of a greater Israel and the power of a minority that has exerted strong influence in behalf of that ideology was one of the things that has contributed to continuing conflict and violence. And on the Palestinian part, really, it's also an ideology, a vision of how to live life, and that is that there should be a world there, a Middle East there, without Israel. And that has exerted continuing interest. And who could argue with the notion that it has been in the interest of the Palestinians to make peace there? Now, the problem in terms of external bystanders has been that while the U.S. has made efforts at various times to try to promote peace, when it came to really using the power or the influence of the United States, we blinked again and again. So, for example, George Bush the First, when he tried to make loans to Israel contingent that they start building settlements, there was such a pushback that he gave up on it and he didn't engage sufficiently. And I think that there has to be a kind of a determination on the part of external parties who are in a position to exert real influence. If you are a real friend of that country, you are going to use that influence. Now, that means that you are presumptuous. You assume that you know what is better for them. But it is hard to argue that creating peace with the Israelis and Palestinians would have been better for them.
There's, of course, the realities here at home, the role of these interest groups that are attached to ethnic groups that are attached to these countries, the lobbying that occurs.
If I may just add that, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we here in the United States, especially because we do have such power and potentially such moral authority, we lived in a country where we had presidents who decided, I am going to do the right thing, going to then take the political consequences. Often, if they are successful with the right thing, the political consequences would be beneficial, but very often they blink. I went when there was bombing by Serbs in Bosnia. I talked to a member of the U.S. National Security Council and said, why doesn't President Clinton do something? And he said, well, the president cannot do anything because people out there in Podunk would not support it. So here is the supposedly most powerful man in the world who, at least one of his associates, said he cannot do anything because it would not be popular. The willingness to take action that is right and could have real benefit that is unpopular would be really wonderful.
George Lopez, you've looked at the United Nations and its role. What has been successful and what has been unsuccessful? How would you say it's doing and what has worked? What has not worked?
Well, I think it speaks to the different expertises of those of us you've had on just now, and that I think one could take a look at the UN Security Council and say, big power politics operates, and you wind up intervening in certain kinds of ways in Libya and not in Syria, and this is what happens when you deal at the big power level. But I tend to have a lot more confidence in groups like the United Nations Mediation Unit and their various panels of experts who've gone into various conflict zones and analyzed who are the people making money on the gun running, where the porousness of the border is, and who are the civil society actors that might be strengthened and stood up by various agencies in order to create conditions of less violence as soon as possible and create more space for political dialogue. And I think that's the UN that doesn't make the front page headlines, and it's not the one that involves veto power of the big politics, but it really is the way that institutions within the Secretariat and associate agencies really work on the ground. And their ability to bring regional actors together, to bring civil society and militaries together in some kind of national dialogue, often aided by institutions like my own, the U.S. Institute of Peace, I think has really made a difference. In every single case, no. But in many more of the cases, we've had reduced violence than we did a decade ago.
And in terms of some of the programs, does it work?
Well, it depends on what else it's tied to. When you intervene in a conflict to separate warring actors and anarchy is broken out, you're intervening at the worst possible time and with only the military tool left to you. Most of us would prefer the work of whether nation states or international organizations to occur much lower in the conflict cycle when you have enough hate speech and you have enough early outbreaks of violence that you know the direction it's going to go, and it begs for more action sooner at various levels rather than only one action left to you 6 months from now, which is a military intervention. The presence of military troops, most especially, protect innocent civilians from being slaughtered. They create zones of protection and maybe even a space where political dynamics of diplomacy might work and bring an end to militant forces ruling the ground and create conditions for more nations being now more focused on where we need to go with better political and economic development to create a more stable peace.
Noren Ripsman?
First of all, in response to Irving Staub, I think ideology matters, but the point is that when interests are such that leaders are attuned to the need to resolve a conflict, then ideology may take a back seat. So how do you explain the Saudi peace initiative towards Israel? I explain that in terms of the increasing threat that they perceive from Iran. And as a result, they're more receptive to trying to resolve a lesser conflict in order to deal with a more pressing adversary from their point of view. So ideology, I don't think, is an insuperable obstacle if the conditions are right for some kind of peacemaking. The other thing I would say is that engagement of society can actually be counterproductive at times prior to the resolution of a conflict. If you're dealing with non-democratic states, you may actually have a choice of engaging society democratization and spreading liberal cooperative values on one hand or stability on the other. And a lot of the peace resolutions, the peace treaties that I studied, actually are peace treaties with states that are objectionable from a point of view of a Western liberal point of view. But if they got the sense that the international community was trying to go above their heads and democratize or spread liberal values as part of the settlement and not accept the state, you never actually would have gotten, say, an Israeli-Egyptian treaty or an Israeli-Jordanian treaty. And so sometimes we have to choose, unfortunately, between our values of stability and peace on one hand or liberal values and democratization on another hand.
What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, all three of you, Irvin Staub, George Lopez, and Noren Ripsman.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.